Thank you very much, Rabbi Eisenberg, for a very nice introduction. You didn't have to stop. You could have continued. You know? I don't mind that. You know, never hurts. And secondly, I want to praise everybody here, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out on a cold night. So I hope the warmth of the great personality, remarkable person, the warmth of our Kukzal, should all warm us up this evening. As I remarked to my Rebbetzin when I left the house, you want to get an idea of Rav Kook, I said, I have in my library, there are two bookshelves that just have the works of Rav Kook that are printed. And there are dozens of manuscripts that he left, Kisrei Yad, that have not yet been printed, which is amazing. Since the time of his passing in 1935. First, I'm going to take a special prerogative to describe how did I get connected somehow with the writings or the vision, whatever we'll call it. I mean, today's talk is only circumscribed by Rav Kook, is a vision of greatness, is tolerance, love and tolerance. That we'll try to emphasize those aspects of it. But from a personal standpoint, I just want to mention how I became connected, or shall I say, in the language of the street, how did I get hooked on the works of Rav Kook and his personality, his outlook on people and on the world. When I was in Yeshiva's of Yitzchak Elchanan, one of my chevrusas, and we're going back a long time ago, in the 1940s, one of my chevrusas, and he's passed away just about 2 years ago, Rabbi Joshua Shapiro, of blessed memory, who was a Rav in Baltimore in his last years before he made Aliyah. His father was the Rav of Atlantic City, New Jersey, from about the time after the First World War, for about 40 years. He was the Rav in Atlantic City, with Moshe Shapiro Zal. And just to describe to you the family that he came from, they were Yerushalmi with Yichus, you could trace their family lineage, because he was named after someone that was a famous Gaon in Yerushalayim, when they used to call him Hirsch Michel, with Tzvi Hirsch Michel, that was his name, and my Chavrusa was named after him. He was when the Brisker of Reb Yeshua Leib Diskin, the name Diskin, came to Yerushalayim in the late 1880s and then the 1890s, this Reb Hirsch Michel was known as a great Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim, and he had no children. And he went to the Brisker Rav, he should give him a bracha. In bracha, after many years, his wife had a son, whom they called Ben Sion, that was the grandfather of my chavrusa. When I was in the yeshiva, he used to correspond with him during the 40s. He used to see the letters from Bote Machsa in the Ir HaTika of Yerushalayim. So they became connected with the idea of having somebody who was connected with Yerushalayim. But when I became friendly, and of course through my chavrusa with Rav Moshe Shapiro, who was the Rav of Atlantic City, he told many times in the course of discussion things about Rav Kook, certain interpretations, pshatim, explanations, and also about the luminous personality of Rav Kook. And when I graduated college in the 40s, a long time ago, I got a present, 5 sforim from Rav Kook that Rav Shapiro gave me. The first one was the Shabbos Haoretz, which is like the Shulchan Aruch on Hilchos Shmita that Rav Kook wrote. And if anyone wants to know in the Lomdus, in the learning of the Heter Mechira about selling land in Eretz Yisrael in order to help what was then known as the colonists, the colonias, the settlers, the yishuv, that they should not be destroyed economically or so forth. His Hakdama there is a masterpiece of learning, which he describes all the aspects of Heta Mechira, the opinions going from the earliest sources who chose the great knowledge of Rav Kook. So that was one sefer. Then there were two sforim on the tshuva's response of Rav Kook that had already been printed in the 40s, the Das Kayan on Yerodea, the Mishpat Kayan that was on Hilchas, the laws of Eretz Yisroel, and also Rav Kook wrote a perush, a comprehensive perush on the Siddur, which is called the Olas Re'iyah. So I got the first chelik of that. And also a collection of essays which was edited by Rav Meir Barlin, who was then alive at that time, whom I saw when he used to come to the yeshiva. He was in America many years before that. He had edited that sefer called Chazon HaGeula, the Vision of Redemption. So these were the sforim that I received from Rav Kook, and I have them there specially on a shelf. And since that time, I acquired many of the other printed volumes. So that's how I became connected since that time, and I'm always looking for anything of the writings or the sayings of Rav Kook, the Zecheinu Levracha. Now, you have to have a brief picture. Where does Rav Kook come from? I mean, after all, he was a European from what we recall more from the Lithuanian background. He was born in Latvia. You know, the Baltic countries, you have those three countries that after Poland you have, if you go north, you have Lithuania, Litta, then you have there Latvia, have Estonia. You have those small Balkan countries, which in his time when he was born in 1865, all were part of the Tsarist Empire. He was born in the Russian Tsarist Empire of that time. In 1865, his whole lifespan was only 70 years. We say only. It was Nifter in 1935 after a prolonged illness, but he was still active as much as possible. So in that span of life, he accomplished what he accomplished. Briefly, as a young person, he came from a family that more or less that seemed to have a connection with Chabad Hasidus, although I don't think they were actually Hasidic Jews. His father was Shlomo Zalman. And as a young child, he was very precocious. He ended up in the Volozhin, the great Volozhin Yeshiva, which was the, you can say, the Royal Academy of Lithuanian Jewry of Torah. Anyone that went to Volozhin was part of a special elite. You know, the people have to understand that's a lecture in and for itself, that the European yeshivas was not just a place where you registered and you came in or so forth. There was a select group when a person was allowed to be accepted, especially in Volozhin, in the 19th century. And who was the Rosh Yeshiva? There was the Netziv, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin Zal, who was the son-in-law of Reb Itzel of Volozhin, who was the son of Reb Chaim Volozhin, who was the Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. That was known as the Beis Harav, the royal family of Torah, and which are connected, of course, to Soloveitchiks, who came out of there. Reb Yosef Deva Halevi was one, another son-in-law, and that's where you have what we call the Beis Harav. So Rav Kook was a Talmud in Yeshiva. He was a phenomenal masmid. His knowledge was unbelievable. And when you talk about Talmudic learning, so probably you could call him an Ilui, but not described in that term, but his accomplishment and knowledge at an early age in both Talmudim, Bavli, Yerushalmi, and Haror, in the Rishonim, and so forth. But he had a special type of affinity for mystic literature, for Inyonim of Kabbalah, which other Lithuanian Gaonim were not that familiar with. They knew about it, they had some acquaintance, but he was steeped in it. He knew, in fact, later on they used to talk about, I heard from people that knew Rav Kook, they say he could quote properly whole pages of a Zohar Kodesh, the Sefer Zohar, which is a very controversial, really, medrash of Kabbalah on the Torah, on the Chemisha Chumsha Torah, many other things, and all of the related Sforim. He was knowledgeable in all of that, and all of the Sifrei Kabbalah. The other famous works of Kabbalah that came out during the medieval times, the works of the Ramban, who was considered the father of Kabbalah, everything that goes with it. But he was a specialist also in the works of Maral Mipag. The Maral, who was from the last part of the 16th century into the early part of the 17th century, who was an extraordinary figure in Central European Jewry. And he was a great interpreter of the works of the Maral, which in recent years have become much more, I would say, more popular, have come to be more quoted. But he sort of opened up a big door in the study of the interpretations of the Maral Mipag. Now, after being in Volozhin, he had a rabbinic post in a place called Boisk, and he was born in a town called Gaiva, whatever town that is in Latvia, and he had a rabbonis. But later on, his brilliance was known by many communities. He was offered many prestigious rabbinic posts, but he stopped. He did not want to. He wanted to go. He had this special ahava for Eretz Yisrael and affinity for Eretz Yisrael. He would say was a total person infused what we would call religious Zionism. In fact, one of the things that he writes in many letters when he came in contact with the secular Zionists, we'll talk a little bit about that. He said their claim was that we are nationalists. We have to go to Israel because we have to be a nation like every other nation. Have to go back to our homeland, have a government, everything in preparation for the establishment of a state. Great ideal. But when it came, when they rejected religion, and that's a very difficult, controversial, and bitter chapter in the history preceding the establishment of the State of Israel. Rav Kook writes many times, you can't put al degel Yisroel ha-tzioniut, ein lo im hadat. Zionist has nothing to do with religion, you can't say that. To be a real Zionist, you have to be religious. You have to really be observant of the Torah, because the very heart, the woof and warp of tzioniut is the Torah. The Torah and the Tzibur, the Klal Yisrael, the whole community of Israel. And what he did was he really abandoned all offers of prestigious European rabbinic positions, and he went to a very poor position at that time. Remember, in 1904, he was in Jaffa. Tel Aviv wasn't even existent, was just a sandy beach. What was Tel Aviv at that time? In fact, they still write in the Gitin of what a get comes from Eretz Yisrael, it says, B'mosa Tel Aviv Yafo, because Tel Aviv became like a suburb of Yafo, which was just a small harbor watering place. A small harbor, Jaffa. Well, full Arabs and all, and he became the Rav of Yafo, and he became well known throughout Eretz Yisrael. And as the Shemitah year of Tofrei Zion, about 1910, approached, and then there was renewed the controversy about, well, what's going to happen to all of the settlements that they had, the kibbutzim, and these were mostly secular Zionists who colonized Israel at that particular time. There weren't that many religious Jews that went to Eretz Yisrael to till the land, to build the land. It was a secular Zionism, those that escaped from, went away of their own reasons from Europe as a movement, and that was sort of Theodor Herzl, who became the leader of the secular Zionist movement, and all the congresses that took place, and the gatherings from different parts of the European, especially European community. So these kibbutzim, that had planted things and they were looking for an economic, some sort of a profit or sustenance. So how could we save them if they were to stop and, you know, do like it says in the Torah of Shemitah, of Shamot, of abandoning the land, let it lie fallow, don't work the land, or so forth? It would have been a disaster. I mean, a literal economic disaster. And they found that he wasn't the first one to do that. There were previous Rabbonim in the 1890s. It was a controversy where they did that. Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Zal was involved. The Kotner of Yeshua Kotner was involved in that. Many other great rabbinic authorities. Reb Shmuel Mohalever was one of the great leaders of Chovevei Tzion, of the religious building of the land of Israel. Did much to acquire, to attract people of means, of sustenance. He attracted the Rothschilds to build Rishon LeZion, and all of that comes out of the efforts of these early pioneers. So Rav Kook in 1910 wrote again about it, and that's where controversy arose. And amongst the, unfortunately what happened is the controversy reached a lot of name-calling. Rav Kook was maligned by many people, even by Gedolim. We'll speak about that later on when it happened. And as time went on, in 1914, there was supposed to be a Knesset of Agudas Yisrael, of the Aguda. The Aguda, the first Knesset, took place years before that and was in another town in Poland. This time, where was the Knesset supposed to take place? In Berlin. And that's just before the first World War, 1900 years ago. So Rav Kook was traveled from Jaffa to Europe. He went to be part of that Knesset. Not that he was in the Aguda. He wanted to be part of Klal Yisrael. So many Jews were coming together in that gathering from the Agudas Yisrael. So what happened, the war broke out, and since officially he was a Russian from Russia, they were the enemy of the Germans, you know, they were the central powers, was Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Turkey, aligned against Britain and France and all the other, and Russia. That was the Allies versus that. So he went back, got back to Switzerland. He spent 2 years in Switzerland and did a lot of, I would say, studying and writing at that time. And in 1916, he was asked by the London, just in the middle of the war, he was asked by the London Jewish community, a group called the Machzikei Hadas, not from the chief rabbinate of Israel, of the British Empire, but was a separate group, and he became the Rav in London. And there he became well known as a great Pesach, rabbinic decisor, but he was an activist in securing what people forget today, the Balfour Declaration of 1917, the famous statement about the British government, which they never really supported, but they made a statement, Balfour. In fact, when I came to Yeshiva in 1942, the Yeshiva, which our Yeshiva was the only one who was called the Zionist Yeshiva, Yeshiva's Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, there was a gathering of all the Rosh Yeshiva, and we celebrated Balfour Day. I think it was November the 9th. At Balfour Day, who do you think was the guest speaker at that time? Harav Pinchas Teitz, the Chayin Levoch of Elizabeth. He was a young man then. He was a speaker. It wasn't political. He spoke about Eretz Yisrael and what it meant to have a Jewish state, which you didn't have at that time. It was amidst of the time of the Holocaust, what was going on in Europe. So that's the sort of background. So Rav Kook, after the war ended, he went back to Eretz Yisrael in 1919. At that time, in 1921, he was elected the Ravad of Yerushalayim, the Rav of the United Communities of Yerushalayim. At least that supported him. There was a separate community that broke off, which is today called the Eder Achredis. That's a separate community. And in 19, I believe it was 1924, he was called the Rav Rashi of all of Eretz Yisrael. He was the first Rav Rashi officially. And of course there was a Sephardic Rav Rashi at that time. And he was called Reb Yankov Meir. Then later on, before that, was a Rav Elisha. And later there was Ben Belhava Zil. These were the Rishoni Tzion, the Sephardic Rabbonim. And Rav Koch became, you know, well known. But the interesting thing, in 1924, he came to America. He didn't come alone. He came as part of a delegation. It was a famous visit of two other Gedolei Yisrael from Europe. One was the Kovner Rav, the last Kovner Rav, official Kovner Rav, Rav Dov Ber Shapiro Zal. He was the Kovner Rav, and which meant that he was like the main Rav of Lithuania, post-war Lithuania, when it was already now an independent republic after the Versailles Treaty, and also Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein Zal, the Rav, the head Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka Yeshiva, Knesset Yisrael, whose brother was the Rav here in Chicago. Many of you probably knew him. Rabbi Chaim Epstein. He was a long time Rav. He was a brother of Reb Moshe Mordechai. So these three great Rabbonim, why did they come to America? They came to America because the European Jewish community, many people didn't realize, was impoverished. Poverty-stricken. After the war, there was devastation in all of the villages and everything else where Jews were. I know my father, Zichron Livracha, was in the Russian army in the First World War and taken a war prisoner by the Germans. That's a different story. But when he came back to his shtetl, Kamenets-Litovsk, he said there was nothing there to earn a living. People were starving. He says, his father, whom I named after, starved to death. That literally, he said, gestorben von Hunger. There were no food. They just didn't say, they had to go to the big cities. So the three Rabbonim came to raise money. It was called Central Relief. In fact, my father, Shalom, in 1924, he saw the three Rabbonim. And he once told me about how they looked, this one, that one, and so forth. It was a great visit for all the many parts of America. I think they came to Chicago, they came to other big cities. And later, Rav Kook went back, of course, to Eretz Yisrael, and he lived till 1935. Now, let's get to that's giving you a background of Rav Kook, you know, with a very sketchy background. As you know, that this was a real person who was involved in activity besides being an extraordinary gaon, extraordinary master of Torah. He was involved in everything having to do with Yishuv Eretz Yisrael before the state. Now, let me just talk about a very interesting points dealing with our approach here of Rav Kook. Love and tolerance. What do we mean by that? It's a question of attitude. An attitude of, you can take different great rabbinic masters, and some people have different attitudes. The best way to describe it, let me take one very sharp example, and you take it from the actual works of Rav Kook. Now, one of the things that he was able to do, and very few great masters of Torah have that ability, he was a prolific writer. He wrote, he had a Hebrew style that was distinctive. You saw the style. He spoke, and when he spoke Ivrit, he did not speak Sephardic Ivrit. In fact, his Psak Halacha, when he argues with Rav Azil, is that Ashkenazi Jews should speak Hebrew like they daven. It should be Ivris. You know, just like we daven. And he always, but he spoke fluent Hebrew and he wrote masterful style. But he has what are known as the Igros HaRe'iyah. The letters, Re'iyah is his Rosh HaTevis. Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. In fact, that means sight, vision. In other words, his name, his acronym was vision. He had a vision of the present, of the past, and the future, things that went above and beyond the reality that you had there in the establishment and the building of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which he took such an active part. So let's give you an example of his attitude of this love and tolerance. When the Shemitah year came in Tofrei Zion, and that's like 1910, who criticized him very bitterly? Someone that was known to the Jewish community in Chicago, who had been here, and was a famous rav, a world-famous rav. Ritbaz, Reb Yankov David Ben Zev Volovsky, who was originally the Slutsky rav. He was known as a Gaon, the Baal Yerushalmi. He wrote an extensive commentary on Talmud Yerushalmi called Ritbaz, Chidushei Ritbaz, and Tosfos Rid, not to be confused with the Rishon, Rabbi Yeshaya Ditrani, which people study in yeshivas. So the Ritbaz came to America, not going into the history. He was a world famous Gaon and very controversial person. He liked to criticize. He, in other words, he saw something that he felt was wrong, he would let loose. And in a very, we would say, almost a negative approach. In fact, there are examples of him when he came to America and he was in Chicago and around the turn of the century. There's a whole sefer written about him being involved in controversies in the community of Chicago at that time, which was a growing group of Russian immigrant Jews that came from, you know, mostly Lithuanian Jews, Litvishyin and so forth, which these Rabbonim were attached to and were heads of that. And he came to Chicago and he got into a big machlekes. That's a subject of something else. There's a little sefer printed called Divrei Emes, written by his opponent. We'll call him his opponent, his Bar Plukta, Harav Shimon Tzvi Album of Zecheinu Levracha, who himself was an Odom Gadol in learning. And that sefer, written by Rav Almud, criticizes the Ritbaz for all his criticisms, and he takes him to task. That's a different story. As one Rav once said, all these controversies, there must be arguing from a sifta de Rekia up there in the Hashemayim, that probably arguments are still going on. So what happened to Ritbaz after he left Chicago, after Machlekes, he went to Eretz Yisrael. He was not known as a Zionist, but he went to Eretz Yisrael. He founded a yeshiva in Tzfas. He had Talmidim. He was a Gaon. His son-in-law was a famous Rav that later settled in Newark, New Jersey, my hometown, Rav Yosef Kanovitz Zal. Rav Kanovitz was a great Talmud Chacham, a Talmud of Slobodka. In fact, my late father-in-law knew him. They called everybody by the shtetl. His name was Yosef. They called him Yoshi Kashadura. There was a literature town, Kashadur. That's where he came from. So Rav Kanovitz was a master orator, a master rabbinic orator besides the Talmud Chacham. He was the son-in-law of the Ritbaz. So, but the Ritbaz in Tzfas was then in Tzfas in those years. And when Rav Kook came out in support of the Heter Mechira, which protected all of the Jews that did not observe Shemitah because they sold the land, you know, Heter Mechira, like you sell chametz, with all the rabbinic support that you find from different sources and precedents, which Rav Kook was a master of, the Ritbaz criticized them severely. And you have in the letters what you call a masa matan, an exchange, where the Ritbaz says, you are covering up on all of these peshim, these sinners, Jews that are mechalel Shabbos, that they don't believe in Hashem, and so forth, you know, ranting and raving in a very negative attitude towards other Jews. And he said, the very fact that you are protecting them, they consider you like them, that you're part of their group. But Rav Kook responds, and you find that anyone that reads Hebrew in the Igos HaRe'iyah, in the second Chelik there, where Rav Kook responds to him. And his response is always a positive one. a positive idea. Now, one of the masterful things, when I read it the first time, I have a note on the side, his response. I have a note, I say, this is Hafnifla. It's a wonderful response. What response does Rav Kook say about his love for all of these people who are sinners? First of all, Rav Kook's approach is, and he says that in his Siddur, a very important point, that when you're dealing with people that are not religious, that seem to be just the opposite of your way of life, and you seem to be connected with them, you don't turn them away. You try to have kiyuv and all. It should be not because you're weak. You know, some people get along with everybody else. You know why? Because they are. It's chanifa. They are. You know, bending. They want to be liked. I want this person to like me, so he agrees with him. You want somebody else, he agrees with him. In fact, unfortunately, sometimes we know there are certain leaders that are like them. They have no real backbone of principle. So Rav Kook says you have to have love that comes not from rakus halev. That's his language in the Siddur. From a weakness of the heart because you want to be liked. You want to be liked by the reform, you like the reform. You want to be liked by the conservative, you want to be liked by the sinners, by the nationalists, by the secularists. No, you have to show that you are what you really are, but you have to show the love in a positive way. You have to express it by saying, and they know exactly where you stand, that you don't agree with their way of life, but you just, it's a question how to get along with other people. Not name calling. You know, you call people names, they're not going to be your friends. But at the same time, it does not mean that you're giving up on principle, on your own ideas. You know, it's an old lesson of how to say no. You can say no to somebody. I'm not going to do this even if you stand on your head and you're no good, I don't like it. That's one way of saying no. The other way is, I say no, I don't believe what you're saying, but right this time, I can't agree with you, and we still maintain a relationship. So Rav Kook brings a raya how far he's ready to go in his ahava, his love for the Jewish people regardless who they are. So he brings a source from the Zohar in Parshas Noach, and this is in the Igros Haria in the second volume. It's on page Kuf Pei Ches, where he says the following. There the Zohar describes the difference between Noach, Avraham Avinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu. So Noach is known, Noach, when his generation was being destroyed, about to be destroyed by the flood, you don't have any evidence in the Chumash that he stuck his neck out to try to save everybody else. He was able to save his family, whatever that means. But he saved it. This is a fact. You see that from the Chumash and the Midrashim. Avraham Avinu, when it came to Sodom, you have a whole section, a parsha there in Parshas Vayera, where Avraham stands and pleads to the Rabbeinu Shalem, at least if you find, he goes, starts from 50 tzaddikim in the city, then he goes down lower until he comes to 10. If you find a minion of tzaddikim in Sodom, maybe Hashem, you won't destroy it. They weren't, so Avraham Avinu gives up. So the Zohar says, Moshe Rabbeinu's chesed was greater than Avraham Avinu. I mean, the Zohar could say it. I'm not saying it, but the Zohar is saying it. And it says, what did Moshe Rabbeinu say when Hashem is going to destroy the Jewish people after the eagle? After Vayachal Moshe? He says, Mecheni Normi Sifrecho Asher Kesavta. He said, I want you, if you're not going to save the Jewish people, wipe me out from your safe. In other words, which is interpreted as meaning, I don't need to be mentioned in history. Rub me out, and I shouldn't have any oil on my bowl. I want to save Jews. That's what he said. He says, that's the Mesiras Nefesh of Chesed. And Rav Kook says, that's what he's trying to do. He feels that every person that should be saved, should be helped, there should be kiyuv, although they are sinners, and they knew what it was. That's a very important stress point that he brings, that's what he writes to the Ritbos. He writes to him, that's what I'm willing, we're different. You know, when the Ritbos was in America, he, in fact, it's recorded in one of the tshuvas of Rav Yehuda Levitzer, was a great rav in America. He wrote a lot of shayos and tshuvas, and the Ritbos writes there something about tzedakah and everything else. He said, there's nothing ever going to happen with American Jewry. They're going to disappear. They're all controlled by the reform, and nothing's going to happen. In fact, I even heard that his son-in-law, Rav Konovitz, Oliver Shalom, this was told to me by Rav Konovitz's, through acquaintance of Rav Konovitz's son. Rav Konovitz, the son-in-law of Ritbos, had a son that was well-known in the general Jewish and academic community. Milton Konovitz, Oliver Shalom, was a professor of law and international relations, economics, at Cornell University for many years. I met him when I was yet a high school student in Newark over there, and I remember him as a young man, Milton Konovitz, but he once said to a friend of mine, Carmi Schwartz, not a relative, who used to be the chairman of the welfare funds in the United States, a professor at Yeshiva University, said that my father, Rav Konovitz, felt there's no hope for Judaism in America. Azoyat HaGazok, that's what he said. So it seems to run in that family, whereas we see what a mistake it was. It never happened. In fact, Yehuda Levitzer, that Shilas and Tshuvas criticizes the Ritbos. He takes him to task on a halachic matter. But I'm just trying to tell you, Rav Kook's approach was a positive one. And even if he had to criticize, he criticized it not by name calling. Let me give an example. Rav Kook came to America and he saw in America in the 1920s, the 30s, immigrant Jews in hundreds of thousands. There was Chilul Shabbos was... It was hard to get a job, you know, not to work on Shabbos, unless you had some sort of a business that you could control. And even in New York State, they had blue laws up to a certain time. You couldn't open up on Sunday even. You could be fined, everything that was going on. But Jews were mechalel Shabbos, unfortunately. And people, we might remember as a child that we were the only ones that maybe that kept Shabbos on our block. Everybody spoke Yiddish, they were mostly European Jews, and that's the way it was. So Rav Kook didn't come out with screaming oratorical presentations that you find in the works of Magidim, of our preachers in Europe when they spoke about the desecration of Shabbos. Like a good example, if you look in the works, and I'm only using it as an example, I mean that was an attitude. In the look in the Sefer, the Sforim of the Minchas Elozer, Elozer Chaim Shapiro Zal of Munkach, who was a famous Gaon. There are people in Chicago that came from the Munkach community. I had in Young Israel of Borough Park, those that knew him. He was very highly critical of when he saw anything was wrong. He lambasted the people. You said you're a poshea or so forth. He was against almost everything. He used to say one of his famous Rosh HaTevis was, you know, it says in the Gemara, Kamsa bar Kamsa, because of people, of the incident between a Kamsa, somebody called Kamsa bar Kamsa, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. He said, you know what Kamsa is? This is a negative approach. Kuf stands for communisten, Jews are the communists. Mem stands for Mizrachisten, for Mizrachi. The Tzadik stands for Tzionisten. And he throws in, the Aleph stands for Agudisten. They're all no good. That was famous, so I heard that from someone who heard it from him, who studied in the Talmud Torah of Munkach. He blasted everybody. But he was a great master of Torah. He was a Gaon in Torah. So in fact, I saw once a video that they have of him, of standing on a wagon speaking to the Jews. He was in Europe speaking to Jews of America about Chilul Shabbos. Very negative attitude. So you can imagine when you're being blasted away, you go in the other direction. You don't want to be subject to that kind of criticism. Rav Kook said an interesting thing about American Jewry, Chilul Shabbos. He said, you know what the word mechalel means? Not just desecration, it means exchange. The Gemara says that when you're mechalel money of Hegdish of certain amounts, it's called chilul. You exchange it. He said a lot of American Jews that don't observe Shabbos, they exchange Sunday for Shabbos. That's a mechalel Shabbos. So at the same time, it's a sharp criticism, but it's not name calling. And it goes deep, because when you start thinking of Sunday as your Sabbath or so forth, you're really straying away. But it's not a name calling type of an approach. That I heard that explanation from one of my teachers at Yeshiva, and later on a neighbor of mine and the rabbin in Burpar, of the late Rab Harry Wahlberg, Zecheinu Levracha, who heard it from Rav Kook when he was young, when he came to America. So that's a sort of a positive approach. Rav Kook said, I have such ava, chavekes es hakol. I embrace everybody. I have so much love for all Jews, for all, he has love for the whole world, for all people. Couldn't stand destruction or enemies or anything. This was his approach of, in other words, he was able to deal with those people who might have been bitter enemies in spirit than in principle, but he was able to get along with them. But he was constantly maligned. You know what the late Rav Goyenzal, whom I knew, was known as an Ilui as a child. He came from Poland, Shlomo Gahanchik. That was his name. So he was a very erratic character, very charismatic person, if you knew about him. So he once told me, when he was here in America, what happened when one of the great Rabbanim that had settled in Eretz Yisrael passed away, the Lublina Rav at that time had passed away in Eretz Yisrael, and so Rav Kook was a Kayan, so he couldn't go into a building where the mess was. It was the old Churvas Rav Yehuda HaChosid, Yerushalayim, the famous shul that was there in the old city. So what happened was the Oron with the mess of the Lublina Rav was there in the front. Rav Kook was going to get up and give a drasha. So what did the Kanoyim do there? They grabbed the Oron and they ran away. They left Rav Kook standing there. They embarrassed him. And they used to call him names. In fact, someone told me that he was my late brother-in-law, when he was in Eretz Yisrael in the year after Rav Kook's Ptira, he heard of Rav Kook's Avos Yisrael, love of Israel, to those people that insulted him. What this person told him, that, you know, Rav Kook as a Rav Rashi, and anyone who is a Rav Rashi has to sign official documents all the time. I mean, I remember years ago I visit the Rav Rashi of Yerushalayim, Rav Kolditz Zal, and when I was in his office, people came in, he had to sign official doc, you had to get the signature of the Rav, you know, for certain papers, for certain institutions. So one of a type like the Anturi Carta comes in, and he has his document, so Rav Kook signs it. As soon as he signs it, this fellow turns away and he spits a spiteis, insulting thing. So the man that was there was ready to attack him. He said, why do you do a thing to such a Rav? So Rav Kook says, leave him alone. And this is what Rav Kook said, if I need a kosher aide for a wedding, I'll use him. That's what he said. That's Avos Yisrael. You know, that's a type of Ava, of love for all Jews, regardless if they were not former, or even for those that were extremists, that called them names, that put placards up all over the place. You know, Yerushalayim is famous for a place, you know, what they call Paskvilin in European Yiddish. Placards all over the place. This one is this, and this one is that, and so forth. You don't know who did it. You used to see it in Borough Park. They called that when the extremists, anti-Zionists, used to get up at 11, 12 at night. All these young fellows used to plaster the place about the state of Israel and everything else of that sort. So Rav Kook's Av went beyond that. He was very close. In fact, there's a statement that he writes, and you hear his approach to this Ahava. Here's an interesting concept. He says, and the language of what he means by peace and shalom and so forth. Es neis ha-shalom, the flag or the standard of peace, anachnu nosim. We, he says, we, whatever I represent, we carry it. Shalom anachnu medabrim. We speak in peace. Lekoro v'gam l'locha. To those who are close and those who are far away. That was an approach that he had. And there are many things to show how the name is, it's still the people afraid to use his name. I'll give you a good example. You know, the famous Rosh Yeshiva Rav Huttner, Zal of Chaim Berlin, who was supposed to be a master interpreter of the Maral. Master interpreter of the Maral. Where do you think he learned how to do that interpretation? He spent time in Eretz Yisrael. He became like a Talmud of the Shiurim of Rav Kook on the Maral. So when Rav Huttner published a Sefer Halacha called Teiras HaNozir, they had the Haskoma of Rav Kook on it. Rav Kook gave a lot of Haskomas, the endorsement. When they republished the Sefer, they took the Haskoma out. Because if you're a member of the Haredi community and you're not a Zionist, how can you have that? They took it out. You know, that still goes on to some extent. But I'm just saying, this is a thing that Rav Kook, I mean, he didn't care who was coming to him or so forth, Aguda, Mizrahi. In fact, Rav Kook had an idea to create a new organization. He wasn't satisfied with Mizrahi and so forth. He made an organization called Degel Yerushalayim, but somehow it never got off the ground. It was too idealistic and so forth. Whatever it was, he was the master when it came to the approach of Av Yisrael and Av Yisrael and the Av of the Jewish people. And in one of his letters, he writes, and with that I'll conclude, what is his attitude to the rest of the world? How do you look at the world, what we call Avos HaBrios, of humanity? You know, as Jews, sometimes we wonder, look at the whole world. The whole world doesn't like us. For centuries we've been harassed, persecuted, annihilated in places, especially since the Holocaust. How can you have any Ava for the rest of humanity or at any time? So Rav Kook used to say, as if to say, what are you going to do with Esav? You know, in the Seders you have Esav and all of that. Esav represents the terrible threatening non-Jewish world is about to crush the Jewish people. Esav, especially in Roman times for hundreds of years, and later on and through the Holocaust years and the awakening of anti-Semitism, everything else. So he quoted a pasuk. You know, pasuk says in Zechariah, what does he say? What does it say? Hasiraisi es domov, ahasiraisi es shikutso mibein shinov. In other words, hasiraisi es domov mipiv. The Navi is saying about the non-Jewish world, about Esav's descendants, I will remove the blood, he said, from his mouth. I will take away the abominations from his teeth. V'nishar gam hu l'elokeinu. Once these things are removed, in other words, there will be redemption for the world also. With the coming of Mashiach, it doesn't mean the destruction of people. It means the redemption of people from all their hate and all of the other things. In fact, that's even inherent in the words of the Rambam at the end of Hilchos Malachim. What is the Messianic era? What it will be? Well, he quotes from Yeshayahu HaNavi, V'chol ha'oretz, all the land will be like the Yam, you know, Kiyam Mechasim, like we'll be covered by the sea. There will be peace. Be peace amongst people. People will be able to get along with each other and all of this hate will disappear. He was a firm believer in that particular approach. And that showed his tolerance and love for all humanity. That's what was the vision of Rav Kook. And this is only a little point from the writings, because in the extensive writings in the Igros, wherever you go, you see this tremendous outburst. It's a flood of Ahava and love and peace and tolerance towards other people, but at the same time is able to criticize those things that are wrong, which he did in Eretz Yisrael as the Rav Rashi. So with his, although his passing was in 1935, but more and more as people have become familiar with that luminous personality, we can draw great inspiration and great change and more most positive attitudes. How we treat other people of all kinds, of all backgrounds, and especially amongst Klal Yisrael. And Rav Kook also said that the worst thing of all is pirut, separation. This is a complete denial of the Hirschian theory in Germany, where Samson Raphael Hirsch, who was a great rabbinic master, created Austritt, to separate yourself from the rest of the community and only have from Jews in your community, nobody else. And you had to meet that standard. If you didn't meet that standard, you were out. You were not really part of the community. Whereas when you talk about Tzibur, the Klal Yisrael, Rav Kook and his Rebbe the Netziv wrote about that, you cannot have that type of separation and pirut that goes against the concept of what we call Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael consists of all kinds of people. Tzibur, they used to say to Darshanim, it's tzaddikim, beinanim, urashoyim. They are righteous, in between, even wicked. We're all part of one community. That's Klal Yisrael, and that's what Rav Kook believed. So may his memory be blessed, and we should take further inspiration from all of his writings and the way he lived his life. Yes. One or two questions.
We have a few minutes for questions if anyone has. Here's your chance.
Well, first of all, I can't hear you. That's one problem I have at this time in my life. My hearing is not so good.
First of all, thank you very much. Yes. It was wonderful. Today, even after, you know, people have been learning, you know, the Kitvei Rav Kook for a long time, they're very, very difficult to understand. Orot and Orot HaKodesh, these farm are very difficult. Were people in his day, did they have a better tefisa for what he was trying to say?
Well,
is he writing in the
I understand what you mean. First of all, his Hebrew, his style is very difficult.
Right.
Very difficult. In fact, my father-in-law, Zecheinu Levracha, was a great rav, and someone gave him a copy of the Eiros HaKedesh, which was a philosophical work. He says, "Ebrech de Tzener." I said, "I can't." And he loved to read. He had a very open mind. I says, "It's hard for him to understand his language." It was he used a certain terminology and what he meant by that. So but the people that were close to him understood what it was. The one who was the editor. Was the editor of his writings was the Nazir, Reb David HaKohen. That's a strange history, if you know what happened. Reb David HaKohen came from Raden, the town of the Chofetz Chaim. In fact, my in-laws, my father-in-law came from Raden, that family. He was the grandson of the Raden Arav. Chofetz Chaim was not the Rav. It was a Raden Arav. In fact, he had relatives here. The family name was Kopstein. There were family here in Chicago. That was from the related to the Raden Arav. So anyhow, he was ready to abandon Judaism. He had gone to Switzerland to study medicine. And Rav Kook was there in Switzerland during those years. And the story is he once saw Rav Kook davening. He was so impressed by his saintliness and it seemed so genuine, he became a Baal Tshuva. And he adopted the vows, the Nedorim of a Nazir. And he became the disciple of Rav Kook, of his philosophical works in Machshava. And if you see anything there from the writings of Rav Kook in the Oros HaKodesh and so forth, who was the Oreich, the editor? Rav David HaKohen. He has another sefer called Kol HaNevuah, that's by him. So he communicated. He followed every aspect of... he was the interpreter that you have. In fact, I once... his son is the Rav of Haifa, who I know is a friend of mine. He once told me about certain things that his father would have said about the writings of the Satmarov and so forth when the father was still alive. So not everybody could appreciate what Rav Kook said or so forth. But he was a master of Torah. I mean, he was lucid when he wrote Tshuvas or anything else.
One more question.
Not a question. I just want to bring Chicago connection to Rabbi Kook. There was a family here by the name of Siegel who had a kosher restaurant in Chicago about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And he told me that his father was the shamus for Rabbi Kook. And he always discussed Rabbi Kook because of his father's connection.
Yeah, well, let me tell you something else. There's a family, Yudkovsky. Yudkovsky? Yeah. So if you've ever been in their house, he has a picture I haven't seen anywhere. It's a big photograph of Rav Kook wearing a white kapota, like on Shabbat. Look, that's what it looks like. Surrounded by like Talmidei Chachomim. It's a marvelous picture because I think they had a connection from Eretz Yisrael. Those people that came into the circle of Kook never were the same after they met him. They realized they were dealing not with a master of Torah, but with a saintly person. He was an amazing individual. I once heard a story, I just have to mention, it occurred to me, a good friend of mine, Rav Notter Greenblatt, the Zayin Gesundte of Memphis, once told me this story. You want to know what the Avos Yisrael of Rav Kook is, how you couldn't appreciate it? He says, take the Soloveitchik family, the whole family. I'm a Talmud of Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, you had Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, but the whole Soloveitchik family, when it came to a relative, Mishpacha, they didn't care whether he was form or not form or anything. They went to help him, they went to visit him. They were so close, he says, that's way Rav Kook was with every Jew. That's the example that I use.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Of course.